The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. This is Richard Martin here with your final edition of the week of the Wake Up Call, coming to you live from Singapore, where the weather has been a disaster. It has never stopped raining. They've had floods, flash floods, you name it. It's been quite a roller coaster, something that apparently they've never seen in living memory. So seems that weather patterns are really playing games with us wherever we go. Anyway, the date today is Friday, the 2nd of July, and I am here to tell you that there will be no show on Monday because it is the Independence Day weekend extension, and as most of you, or many of you at least, will know, we are having no show any longer on Sundays. As I said before, it's my fault. I bit off more than I could chew. I really have no available time to prepare what amounts to a third show of the week. So very sadly and regretfully, I have had to bow out of my Sunday discussion group show. So there will be no longer a discussion group on Sundays, but the two weekly wake-up calls will continue apace. We will, of course, be back next Friday at the same time. For now, please just bear with me and let's have a look at what's going on. The stock market has collapsed quite sharply, as I'm sure you know. I did get an email from Ken Nestler, who basically drew my attention to an article in Forbes magazine explaining why the Greater Depression still lies ahead. Obviously, Messrs. Bernanke and Geithner still don't understand the real causes of this debt crisis. You cannot count upon them to tell us when the Great Recession, as they call it, is over, or even to provide a plan to prevent another one in the future. Now, ladies and gentlemen, make no mistake about this. The cause of the Great Depression of the 1930s and the depression that we have right now, euphemistically called the Great Recession, was exactly the same, identical, an over-leveraged economy. Excessive debt levels are the direct result of the central bank providing artificially low interest rates of superfluous lending on the part of the commercial banks. The easy money provided by banks eventually brings debt in the economy to an unsustainable level. And at that point, the only real and viable solution is for the public and private sectors to undergo a protracted period of deleveraging. And the resultant depression is, in fact, the healing process at work, which is marked by the selling of assets and the paying down of debt. If you like, it is nature's way of saying, enough is enough. We cannot do this anymore. You have abused the system, and now it is payback time. And now we must take over. That's to say, the forces of nature are going to take over, and we are going to rearrange the ships on the Titanic. And unfortunately, politicians today are focused on fighting this natural healing process by promoting the accumulation of yet more debt. And during the last economic contraction, the Federal Reserve took interest rates to near 0%, and the Obama administration is leveraging up the public sector to record levels in a bid to re-leverage the private sector. The government's philosophy is tantamount to sticking a smitten man in the freezer so he won't have to suffer the pain associated with thawing of the extremities. Now, during the Great Depression, real gross domestic product plummeted 32%. The Great Recession, as they call it, which we are still struggling through, clearly, began in December 2007, and that's according to the National Bureau of Economic Research. And in contrast to the 1930s, GDP during this depression has shrunk only 3.6% from the fourth quarter of 2007 through its low point in the second quarter of 2008. Between the fourth quarter of 2007 and the first quarter of this year, GDP contracted near 1.1%. Now, the contraction in GDP during the Great Depression was the direct result of consumers paying down debt and selling off assets. Household debt as a percentage of GDP reached nearly 100% in 1929. Now, to put that number in perspective, household debt didn't go back above 50% of GDP until 1985. It was not until the first quarter of 2009 that household debt once again approached the Great Depression level of 100% of GDP. Between the start of the Great Depression and the end of World War II, household debt fell from 100% to just above 20% of GDP. Now, getting there was a painful process, but such deleveraging was the only real cure for an economy swimming in debt. Thanks to government efforts to carry out debt-fueled consumption binges, during today's Great Depression, household debt has barely contracted at all. It fell to 92.5% of GDP in the first quarter of this year. To make matters even worse, during this crisis, the government's response has been to increase its own borrowing dramatically. At the start of the Great Depression, gross federal debt was 16% of GDP. It peaked just below 44% when the Depression ended. Now, while the national debt did increase significantly during that period, it was still relatively benign when viewed from a historical perspective. The U.S. entered the Great Recession, so-called, with gross national debt equal to 65% of GDP. It has since exploded to 90% of GDP. This is very, very grave, ladies and gentlemen. And comparing the relatively innocuous level of the 1930s with today's pile of government debt clearly illustrates the perilous state of the economy that we're in. National debt did rise dramatically during World War II, but it topped out at 120% of GDP in 1946. And consumer debt plunged concurrently. So while the nation was adding debt to fight and win a global war, households were taking the necessary steps to ensure their balance sheets were well prepared for the aftermath of the battle. Today, gross national debt and household debt are both at or above 90% of GDP for the first time in history. Many observers, unfortunately, including most of those in power, have concluded that the government must spend more while consumers rein in their debts. And the strategy is based on the belief that once the economy perks up, they can unwind that debt. Well, there are two very serious problems with that theory. One is that government spending doesn't increase GDP. It only chokes off private sector growth. And the other is that politicians never regard the present as a good time for the government to pay off its debts. And the result is that the country is left to the private sector, reducing a massive overhang of debt. And as households curb spending, GDP slows and the ratio of debt to economic output grows even further. So since the real cause of this recession has yet to be addressed, we are moving inexorably closer to causing a complete and identical repeat of the Great Depression. If policymakers don't understand that the progenitor of the depression is debt, they will also be unable to provide a pure solution. I mean, what people don't understand is that so much of what passes for productivity, i.e. government spending, is in fact not at all the same as real business, industrial and commercial productivity, which involves creating and maintaining wealth. The government is nothing more than a leech on wealth. It has no place in the productivity scenario. And that's why, unfortunately, we are headed towards maximum meltdown, because what the government is providing is nothing more than a band-aid to plaster over the gangrene which is spreading rapidly through the economy. Now, the European GDP, based on the exchange rate last year, is about $2 trillion less. Bretton Woods made the USA the demand and everyone else the supply. So now you have the USA, the number one consumer of China's export, the number one consumer of Japan's exports, the number one consumer of the UK's exports, the number one consumer, Germany's exports, Brazil's exports. France has Germany as number one consumer and the USA is number six. Spain has France as the number one consumer, Germany number two, and the USA, again, number six. Italy has Germany as number one consumer and the USA is number four. But the largest consumer of European Union exports, when added up, is the USA. Russia actually imports more from the USA than it exports. So all these economies export finished products to the USA, and all are net importers of raw materials. Their exports of finished goods pays for their import of raw materials. And by the way, India isn't even on the list. Its number one consumer of exports is the UAE, barely, with the USA, a close number two by fractions of a percent. Ultimately, when you look at global trade flows, every economic zone or country or nation either has the USA as number one consumer of its exports, or the number one consumer of its exports has the USA as the number one or two consumer of its exports. It's why the global trade system set up in 1944, the Bretton Woods systems, and it's imploding. Because the number one consumer on earth, or on demand, has reached maximum potential. Imagine how much raw materials like oil are used on a daily basis to fuel the machine. The USA consumes 20 million barrels, sustaining its consumption from the rest of the world-based economy, while the rest of the world is burning 64 million barrels a day. And that's to support their supply to the USA-based economies. 30.6 barrels a year times, let's say, $70 a barrel is a demand for $2.14 trillion a year. And that's just one component of the raw material requirements. The only source of U.S. dollars is U.S. consumers. So with the primary engine of creation, the U.S. real estate sector, they have maxed out. The supply of U.S. dollars has stopped growing in the past 9 months and has shrunk by about $500 billion. And you think Americans just might be angry? Imagine the USA is a corporation, and after 65 years of slavery, the employer is basically saying, sorry, not good enough. And since you're all worthless, you're not getting all the benefits you were promised at the start. The designers of the Bretton Woods system had to know that it was inevitably doomed from square one. The only people that can claim otherwise are either idiots or liars. You would have to be pretending to know how economics works to imagine exponential growth can be sustained forever. Ladies and gentlemen, the key problem is that it's not the economy that is driving the monetary system. The economic system demanding the monetary system to supply it with money to sustain the economy. The way the global system or economics has been administered for centuries now is the monetary system drives the economic system. The monetary system demands that the economic system supply it with ever greater economic activity to sustain the monetary system. The monetary system has at its core the compounding interest equation, and in the case of the banking system, the continuous interest equation. Let's say the economy is based on chopping down trees. The equation eventually demands that trees be chopped down faster than they regrow. In the current system, the equation is demanding debt-free consumers to be used faster than they can be created. Basically, the supply of new consumers willing and able to consume to their maximum potential is growing slower than the demand for them by the monetary system. The result is the economy, which is being commanded by the dictates of the equation, is collapsing since it cannot supply the demand. That, in a nutshell, is basically what is going on and has been going on for centuries. Basically, what the population of Earth is doing on a daily basis is to sustain the monetary system doomed to fail. The top lives off the yield from the bottom, and when the top is demanding that trees have to be chopped down faster than they regrow, that's game over. The compounding interest equation was demanding the price of real estate in the USA to increase faster than the economy could supply, and it collapsed. But it's currently demanding the whole global economy to grow faster than it can, and the whole global economy is basically collapsing. The entire monetary supply of the world is debt. The top owns it all, and interest is the cost to rent it, and the cost is hidden in the price of everything. The top lives off the yield from the bottom. The equation is, if you like, the Lord, which is demanding tribute. Supply the tribute, and the Lord will supply benevolence. Fail, and the Lord will supply malevolence. The vast majority are completely and totally oblivious as to what is going on. They have as much control over their destiny as leaves blowing around in a cyclone. All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, here I am. It's Richard Martin, the wake-up call. The date, again, is Friday, the 2nd of July, just before the long weekend, and I hope you're all going to relax, have a good time, and chill out and get ready for the rigors of the rest of the summer, which are going to be quite substantial, in my opinion. Okay, so now don't forget that our call-in number has actually changed. It is now 888-874-4888. And that's our new number since about 3 weeks. Again, the toll-free call number is 888-874-4888. If you want to email me with your comments and questions, you can do that too at rm@gfawd.com. Again, that's RM for Richard Martin at GFAWD for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design .com. Let me give you that once more. It is rm@gfawd.com. My private phone number, for those of you interested in talking to me about your personal finances, is area code 941-441-1682. Again, my personal number to be called at any time. If I don't answer, please leave a message. I will call you back. It's 941-441-1682. Okay. Well, at times like these, it's hardly going out on a limb to say that we are headed for very hard, severe, and grim economic times. In fact, it seems like almost everyone in the financial world is either declaring that a recession is coming or is busy preparing for one. And the truth is that bad economic signs are everywhere. Consumer confidence is plummeting, big banks are hoarding cash, top financial experts are issuing recession warnings, and it seems like almost everyone is trying to accumulate as much gold as possible. Now that the G20 nations have all pledged to dramatically cut government spending in an effort to get debt under control, worries about a double debt recession have reached a fever pitch. So will we see the fully fledged economic collapse that so many analysts are warning of before the end of 2010? Well, it's possible, but probably the full effects of this thing will not really be seen before 2011, or maybe even 2012, which does not mean that you shouldn't be going out there and preparing yourself. You absolutely should. And there are so many variables and so many moving parts that it is always difficult to predict exactly how things will play out. What does seem virtually certain, however, is that we are heading into a time of extreme economic stress. And I really cannot emphasize enough, ladies and gentlemen, how important it is for you all to prepare yourselves, to get yourselves, financially get your house in order. I am on record as recommending that you really walk away from your debts if they are heavily underwater and you really have the feeling that you will never come to pay them off, which more and more people are now experiencing given the fall in real estate prices, which seems absolutely unstoppable. The only thing that I would say, and I always warn you and offer this as a caveat, do not move anywhere without consulting a local real estate lawyer. There are ramifications to this. They are serious, and the banks are now equally serious when it comes to taking steps, given that the situation with those walking away on what they call strategic defaults has reached epidemic pitch. The banks just cannot be seen to allow this to continue. So watch out for any follow-up from a decision that you may make of that nature. I don't want to be responsible for you making that decision and certainly, you know, coming back and saying that I advised you badly. This is not advice per se. The advice comes from your consulting a real estate lawyer and finding out what the ramifications are, and I absolutely assure you that they are different in every state, and some of them are much, much worse than others. So there you go, ladies and gentlemen. Do take the necessary steps. And along with that, of course, comes the same old advice. Those of you who are of a mind to leave the country should be making your plans right now. We should be beyond the stage where you're deciding where you want to go. I've been talking about this for several years. Now it's got to a point where I believe you should be actively engaged in making the arrangements. Looking at the housing market, the homes in the foreclosure process sold at an average 27% discount in the first quarter, as almost a third of all U.S. transactions involved properties in some stage of mortgage distress, and that comes from RealtyTrack, Inc. A total of 232,959 homes sold in the period had received a default or auction notice or were seized by the banks. And that's again from RealtyTrack in a recent report. That's down 14% from the fourth quarter and 33% from the peak a year earlier, according to RealtyTrack. The average price of a distressed property was $171,971. And that's also according to RealtyTrack out of Irvine, California. And I quote, "The discount will probably stay between 25% and 30% as lenders carefully manage the number of new foreclosure actions in order to avoid flooding the market." End of quote. And that's from Rick Shager, RealtyTrack's Senior Vice President for Marketing. And I quote, "We are clearly creating more properties that will be sold at distressed prices than the market is absorbing." There were more than 250,000 new bank seizures in the first quarter. Home foreclosures set a record for the second straight month in May, with increases in every state as lenders stepped up property seizures, and that's according to RealtyTrack again. Distressed sales totaled more than 1.2 million last year, a 25% increase from 2008, and a more than four-fold rise from 2007. Again, from RealtyTrack. Such transactions accounted for 29% of all sales last year, up from 23% of sales in 2008 and 6% in 2007. The average foreclosure discount was 25% in 2009, 22% in 2008, and 26% in 2007. A quote-unquote normal market would show foreclosures accounting for less than 2% of sales. That's according to Shaga again. Bank-owned properties sold for an average 34% discount in the first quarter, up from 32% both in the previous quarter and a year earlier. Such properties accounted for 19% of all U.S. home sales, up from almost 16% in the fourth quarter and down from 21% in the first quarter of 2009, according to RealtyTrack. Properties in default or scheduled for auction sold for an average discount of almost 15%, up from almost 14% in the previous quarter and down from 16% a year earlier. And these homes are often sold in short sales where lenders accept less than the outstanding loan amount for the property. Sales of properties either in default or headed for auction accounted for 12% of all sales. The average price was $154,740 for bank-owned properties and $199,950 for homes in default or scheduled for auction. Nevada had the highest proportion of distressed sales of any U.S. state, with 64% of all transactions involving properties in mortgage distress. California ranked second, with such sales accounting for 51% of all sales, and Arizona was third, 50%. Discounts on distressed homes were highest in Ohio, Kentucky, and Illinois, where they sold for an average of at least 39% less than non-foreclosures. Does it really surprise anyone that new home sales were at historically low levels in May? And that home sales reported earlier in the month were also lousy? People who were planning to buy a house did so before the government's $8,000 tax incentive expired. Now, of course, there are fewer buyers. The same thing happened in the auto market when cash for clunkers expired. Well, very serious. I mean, there is no sign that this thing is over. There is no reason why there should be a sign that this thing is over. There are mountains more of these foreclosures still being held back by the banks in order not to flood the market. And as I say, there's no solution. These homes must be foreclosed on. The owners must be evicted, along, of course, with their tenants. And the situation, as I said at the beginning of the program, must be reset. And the reason I give you all those figures is because I want you to really understand to what extent things are getting worse. It's not just words. It's not just, you know, an emotional outburst that one hopes will be sort of forgotten, but that the basic comment will remain. No, this is comments. This is comments which are backed by hard and fast statistics, ladies and gentlemen. Well, I had a quick email from Rosemary Otica, who says, thank you for your informative and passionate program. I totally agree with Sarita, who said it so nicely. I am very worried about my savings in T-bills, but the U.S. dollar sure looks doomed. What to do? Well, Rosemary, your savings in T-bills are really going to be okay for the time being. We'll have a, you know, quite a serious warning, I think, before you need to worry. You know, remembering that those T-bills are short-term, you should have plenty of time to redeem your bills and not have to roll them over. So anyway, ladies and gentlemen, I think the time has come to take our mid-program break, and so I will be back in just a few moments.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Join us, Bruce and Marianne Curtis, Fridays at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network for Truth and Freedom. We present provocative conversations with the world's most brilliant minds in the areas of holistic health, spiritual wisdom, politics, and a host of other topics. Some of our topics include the latest work in non-invasive therapy on the brain, the truth beneath the global economic meltdown, healing power of the breath, and the sublime truth beyond all religious traditions. In this age of transformation, we need to look beneath the surface appearance of things to see the underlying reality. From material that is always illuminating and often liberating, tune in to Truth and Freedom on the Progressive Radio Network Fridays at 3 p.m.
Listen to Of Consuming Interest every Friday from 2 to 3 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Jim Turner, attorney in Washington, D.C., chairman of the board of Citizens for Health. Every Friday from 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern, we discuss a topic of consuming interest, often about health, but also about politics, commerce, and whatever the current topic of the day might be. Of Consuming Interest, 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern, on the Progressive Radio Network.
Don't miss out on Dr. Michio Kaku's weekly show, Explorations. Dr. Kaku is the only scientist with his own nationally syndicated radio show. Explorations is the program that explains complex physics with an accessible approach. So take an exploration with Dr. Michio Kaku, Tuesdays at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, to discuss topics ranging from space exploration to stem cell research.
This is Mitchell J. Rabin to tell you that we have two new time slots every Monday and Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Progressive Radio Network. Join me as I interview and dialogue with the sung and unsung heroes of society with passion and with commitment. Scientists, healers, filmmakers, musicians, environmentalists, and gurus on Mondays, and a call-in show where you'll be the focus on Wednesdays. Again, Monday and Wednesday at 6 p.m., join Mitchell Rabin as together we create a better world.
Progressive Radio Network. Information for the independent mind.
Well, I got an interesting email from Peter Marciano quoting The Automatic Earth. I know Peter's a very avid reader of The Automatic Earth, as indeed am I, one of the very best blogs that reflect the state of the world today. I can't recommend it highly enough. Again, it's called The Automatic Earth, in case any of you are of a mind to check it out. I will quote from it in order to do Peter justice. He says, "The picture becomes increasingly clearer as Washington lifts its veil. A financial overhaul that was supposed to be a momentous effort has finally been voted in, only to reveal that none of the Wall Street banks will be effectively affected until 2022, which is the sort of number that you can read as meaning never. At the same time, Capitol Hill has thrown out a proposal to provide emergency support for millions of Americans who remain unemployed for more than 26 weeks, while those who haven't found a job for 99 weeks or more are in the indefinite doghouse. It is truly a matter of bail the banks and screw the people. What remains to be seen is how those people will react. All the more so when they find out that those same Wall Street banks will soon come calling again for more bailouts, which is now inevitable and guaranteed to happen. Our fine leaders may try to find a creative way to do it, one that won't attract too much attention, but you can bet there'll be more taxpayer money flowing to lower Manhattan, while for ordinary citizens, services will be cut, taxes raised, and jobs disappeared. Nor is this an exclusively American phenomenon. European countries face the same fate, even though it's not as easy over there as a Republican filibuster to condemn citizens to abject poverty. Well, the options are deadly simple, ladies and gentlemen. We will find out over the next few months that the banks are screamingly undervalued and underfunded, and that not bailing them out will lead to bank runs and panics. How bad the situation already is becomes obvious through, for instance, Reuters' James Saft, who writes that in the next 3 years, and I quote, banks around the world must refinance more than $5 trillion of debts in the coming 3 years. For banks in the UK, according to the Bank of England Financial Stability Report, the refinancings amount to around $1.2 trillion by the end of 2012. If banks in Britain raise funds at the same pace they have been this year, they will only collect half of their needs in time. US banks have issued $230 billion of debts in the first 5 months of the year, about 60% of the rate they'd need to achieve over the three-year period. Eurozone banks have issued $133 billion, or about 70% of their needed run rate. One easy-to-see consequence is that, all things being equal, the cost for banks to issue debt should rise, as should competition among banks for consumer deposits. The track record of the past 3 years tells us one thing is likely. The banks will get their money, courtesy of government support, if needed, unless there is a profound sovereign debt crisis, we can count on governments taking the needed steps to see that the banking system doesn't fall over for lack of funding. So if liquidity or support schemes need to be extended or invented anew, they will be. The Bank of England used an assumption that for every 7 basis points of additional lending, spread charges by the banks should create a 0.1% permanent reduction of GDP. On their estimates, mapping capital in banking by 1% then equates to present value cost of about 4% of UK GDP. This puts into perspective not just how challenging it will be to create growth going forward, but just how artificially growth during the boom was goosed by very loose and easy lending. For the UK and for Europe, this will be happening at the same time that fiscal austerity programs will be dampening growth. Something has to give, and it will probably be monetary policy. Look for extraordinarily low rates for a very long time and for new and bigger quantitative easing programs, i.e. money printing. In short, banks have enormous funding problems, and even if they can sell debt, they'll have to pay a lot more to do so in the same marketplace that's already drowning in sovereign and municipal debt. The ultimate consequence is going to be that not only will your wages, pensions, healthcare, and other services fade and slowly vanish, what's left of your wealth will increasingly be confiscated and handed to a bunch of rich gamblers with clout. Well, that is not a very positive statement, ladies and gentlemen, but I fear it is exactly what you are going to see ahead. Now, I appreciate that today is a fairly purple day in terms of statistics, and somewhat advanced economics. And I ask you to bear with me. This doesn't happen every week. It doesn't even happen every month. But from time to time, as I've told you before, we need to present you with really a backdrop, a scenario that requires us to cite these statistics, to give you comparative statistics, so that you can see for yourself that even if you don't understand the merits of the statistics alone, just comparing them to the previous year or the previous 2 or 3 years should give you a flavor of just how grim and how serious and how intractable this entire problem is. You know, Peter Orszag fell on his sword last week. Barack Obama's budget director left after disagreeing with Obama's tax pledge. Read my lips. The executive might have said, no new taxes for people earning less than $250,000. Mr. Orszag hastened to distort the record, and I quote, I want to emphasize that it would be inaccurate to say that I have told the president personally that I'm leaving because of concerns about our fiscal policies. End of quote. And that was in an exit interview. Mr. Orszag can't seem to put a simple sentence together, but he certainly can count. According to the last census results, there were 1.7 million households in America with incomes of $250,000 or more. Even if you took an additional $250,000 in tax from each one of them, raising the effective rate on many of them to nearly 150% of income, you would still have a $1 trillion deficit. Ladies and gentlemen, there is no way the rich alone are going to be able to shoulder America's growing tax burden. Now, Peter Orszag feels strongly that this is a pledge that has to be broken, and that's according to an administration source. Mr. Orszag is only the latest OMB casualty of modern debt financing. The first came a quarter of a century ago next month. David Stockman was the propeller head of the early 80s. He could count too. When the Reagan team refused to raise taxes to close the budget, the deficit gap, Stockman moved on. He quit on August the 1st, 1985, and went on to write his memoir, The Triumph of Politics, Why the Reagan Revolution Failed. Stockman was right. Politics prevented the Reagan administration from getting control of deficits. If the Reagan administration had been in the oil business at the time, it might have invented deep water drilling. Instead, one of the Reaganites' signal contributions was to liberate America's conservatives from their hatred of deficits. The Republicans didn't know it at the time, but their innovation would later prove disastrous. But Reagan was able to increase federal debt without causing a breakdown in federal finances. When interest rates were falling from 15% to 3%, it was hard to go broke. Almost no matter how much debt you had, you could refinance at lower rates, which of course gave the rest of the world the wrong idea. It seemed like you could borrow forever. Alas, all good things, all bad things come to an end. Private borrowing in the private sector peaked out in 2007. Since then, it's been downhill. Of course, the lesson wasn't lost on the feds. They've got their economists, their theories, and their elections. And as you know, people come to think what they must think when they must think it. The Europeans now have their backs to the wall. In front of them is the bond market, unwilling to extend more credit. They have to believe that cost-cutting is the way forward. So far, practically every government in Europe has promised to take a sharp knife to the fat budget deficits. Since we've been talking about this, almost every headline takes up the story: brutal cuts, budget slashed, pain, suffering, belt tightening, all in the name of austerity. But what can you do when you can't borrow any more money? On Monday, it looked like the gods were against them too. Greece announced a new borrowing campaign, and the Parthenon got struck by lightning. His youth will only put up with so much. Poor old Ireland, too, is in a bad shape. The Irish have been good sports about it. They've embarked on one of the most aggressive cost-cutting campaigns in the old world. But do you think lenders are pleased? No. They've actually forced up Irish sovereign debt yields. And now investors are wondering, what next? How much austerity can governments deliver? How much is enough? And what happens to stocks while the rest of the world is deleveraging? The Dow fell more than 200 points the other day. The stock market looks ahead, as the experts say. What's it looking at? Well, I sure don't know. But if it opens its eyes at all, it will see that actually the world isn't deleveraging. Not yet. The U.S. is still borrowing heavily. Its borrowers show no sign of fatigue. Meanwhile, the G20 meeting ended with a call to trim public debt, but no one said, now. That's what the bond market says when it's had enough. And for the moment, governments are still adding to their debts in anticipation of lowering them when the economy picks up. But wait, what makes them think the economy is getting better? Aren't we headed for a double-dip recession? Uh-huh. And if the economy goes down again, won't unemployment go up? Maybe to around 12% this time? Uh-huh. And won't tax receipts go down? Uh-huh. And won't public spending go up with more unemployment compensation, food stamps, and counter-cyclical social spending? Uh-huh. And won't deficits actually grow larger, not smaller? Uh-huh. Which brings us back to the aforementioned David Stockman, Ronald Reagan's director of the Office of Management and Budget. Stockman gave a speech last October in which he predicted that the economy would not recover as promised, and that the budget deficit, at about $1.5 trillion, would grow to as much as $2 trillion this year. Stockman may be right again. Well, Ireland is a mess. Just drive down the street. You'll see houses for sale everywhere, and there are unfinished housing developments and empty offices too. But the funny thing is that prices haven't fallen. That's the government's contribution to this problem. They've made it worse by taking in all the bad property debt into one very bad bank backed by the government. This has meant that new lenders, builders, and developers haven't had to own up to their mistakes. There's been no rush to sell, and few desperate sellers, because the worst of them can effectively refinance through the government's bad bank. Of course, it means that the property market can't correct itself either. Everybody's happy when prices are going up. But when prices are going down, they don't seem to have the stomach for it. So they do everything they can to stop it. Of course, it creates this zombie situation where the market can't correct itself, it can't clear, because prices aren't allowed to fail. So people who don't have money don't want to buy, and people who don't have the money can't sell. Well, it's a ridiculous situation, ladies and gentlemen. It's absolutely absurd, but that's what we live with today, and all because of government hubris. We have to sit and tolerate the egotistical eccentricities of people like Ben Bernanke and, you know, Barack Obama, so we don't have to tolerate the implosion of the economy. But, of course, the economy is going to implode anyway, despite what these people say or what they do. And the chutzpah of one particular Fed official coming out and saying that bloggers didn't know what they were talking about. You may have read about this. They just said, you know, don't listen to the bloggers, the internet bloggers. Why not? What exactly has the Fed done to prove that it knew what was going on, that it was competent to deal with the problems? Not much, if I may make so bold. All right, well, when it comes to judging government and business, there's clearly a double standard in academia. There's something called the agency theory, which is used in business education. Those of you who've been to business school, the theory basically goes like this. CEOs and top management do not necessarily maximize shareholder profits. They instead maximize their own profits. Also, shareholders have a tough time controlling CEOs. Often, the board of directors is closely tied to the CEO. And to make matters worse, few shareholders vote in corporate elections. Of course, agency problems are very real. Why aren't students taught the same perspective about politicians and bureaucracies? Instead, the government is always presented as an altruistic market regulator. The government's intentions are never brought into question. But the agency problems are similar and even worse in the political process. For example, in politics, many voters do not participate either. And while this is a huge problem in agency theory, not a word in business school ever criticizes the political process. Also, board connections are the epitome of corruption in agency theory, but what about the special interest connections in Washington? The questionable relationships between the CEO and his board are nothing compared to the corrupt backroom DC deals. In the end, the CEO of any company behind investments does a far better job of representing the investor interests than any local senator or representative. Clearly, academia realizes that it's outside the Garden of Eden. Top management can stray from profit-maximizing goals. But why the double standard? Well, for one, academia relies on the belief that government officials work for the common good. After all, academics are employed by public universities or are heavily subsidized by the federal government. Professors claim their own profession searches for objective truth. Of course, for the common good. Oh, and by the way, these aren't just left-leaning professors. They're academics who believe that government officials do not serve the public good, and such professors also recognize corporate agency problems. However, the same professors view their own profession as a kind of holy arbiter of truth and objectivity for the world. Academia is dogmatism and bias thinly disguised as objective and well-researched truth. I can sum up the real intellectual evolution of an academic with an example from economics. First, an undergraduate student becomes brainwashed by either Keynesian economics or, if lucky, Austrian economics. In graduate school, no amount of research from either side will undo this brainwashing. An Austrian student rarely becomes a Keynesian, and the opposite is true as well. In academia, everyone supposedly searches for the truth, but no one ever changes their minds. The Milton Friedmans remain in their camp, and the John Kenneth Galbraiths remain in theirs. Government officials want you to believe their task aims at the common good, and professors want you to believe that they research for truth. But academia is really the same racket under a different guise. Out of CEOs, academics, and politicians, the CEOs are paradoxically the most honest. They make no bones about it. Clearly in it for the money. But honesty doesn't get one far in American political theater. Maybe one day every classroom will teach agency problems in government with equal eagerness as agency problems in corporations. But somehow, I strongly doubt it. All right, well, let's take an email now from our good, trusted, and dear friend, Sarita, who says, "Dear Richard, it was quite a shock to hear you say you would no longer host a discussion group. However, I understand. It has been an hour with amazing information, and I'm sure the challenge of being so extraordinary in your delivery of this took up much energy and time. I just don't know how you did it. It has been obvious in the wake-up call that you give 1,000% of yourself. Each week I feel we are receiving masterclasses which are special and unique in every sense of the word. Shall always treasure the discussion of these past weeks. As time passes, the information on the death wish discussion will be even more poignant, since it will be clearly seen as foreshadowing events that are clearly manifesting. Thank you very much for all your hard work, Sarita. Well, as always, Sarita, I treasure that comment. I am very humbled by it and very profoundly moved by your feelings. I really don't think that there's that much more to add to much of the conversations we've been having. The death wish is quite clearly, in my mind, the overriding future motive of governments worldwide, as they see that they simply cannot survive, as the politicians see that they are not in any position to mitigate the problems of the automatic system in place, we're just going to be able to see more declines, more devastation in the economy. And frankly, ladies and gentlemen, it is up to you to be aware of this and to take whatever steps you can to lighten the burden for yourself and for your families. The problem with the currency that nobody understands is that when you lose value in a currency like the US dollar, the whole world suffers. I like to use the analogy of a small island far from anywhere which uses seashells as its currency. And I say, okay, what if one day there is a very strong tide which brings in exactly double the number of seashells as in circulation in the economy? What if the tide goes out leaving the seashells? Does that mean that when the population wakes up the next day, they are twice as wealthy just because they have twice as many seashells? Of course not. Money is nothing more than a means of exchange at a given exchange rate. And I assure you, if more dollars come into existence, if more seashells get washed onto the shore, the value of Rome, the value of the American markets is going to collapse, and it will be short order before you, the listeners, are on your yacht listening to my broadcast from a power outlet in the desert that I have not yet localized. So be careful. Make sure that your venue as to where you want to live is good for at least the next 20 to 25 years. Remember, please, to equip the system, you know, with whatever you can so that you help others in the same way. I have to say that the monetary inflation distorts the price signals on which the economy relies and leads to the wastage of resources and the destruction of wealth. And when it comes to understanding the world of economics, one of the problems is that the link between cause and effect is sometimes so long and indirect that it will only be evident to the people that had a good understanding of economic theory to begin with. And this is certainly the case with monetary inflation, which sometimes gives a short-term boost to markets and economies while it weakens the economy's foundations. Now, we don't have inflation right now. We have strong deflation. And even if the proverbial seashells were to be washed ashore, they would be subsumed by the disappearance into the ethers of the seashells currently in existence, so that the new seashells would simply replace the old seashells. But you see, the difficulty of seeing the link between cause and effect is why so many people are able to claim with straight faces that more monetary and or fiscal stimulus is needed to address an economic downturn that was caused by earlier rounds of monetary and or fiscal stimulus. It can take years for the problems caused by monetary inflation to ripple through the economy, but the adverse effects of some other stimulus measures have shorter lead times. For example, when the government directly pays people to buy things they otherwise wouldn't have bought, there will tend to be a short-lived boost followed by a plunge. And something along these lines has actually occurred in the U.S. residential property market over the past year. And with housing prices having been propped up by government incentives and with considerable demand having been sucked from the future, the U.S. housing market is now in a weaker position than it was 12 months ago. So it must be time for more stimulus, right? It should always be kept in mind that stimulus of any kind is a zero-sum game at best. This is because the government doesn't generate any wealth of its own. As I said before earlier, it doesn't create wealth. It just redistributes existing wealth. And in reality, stimulus is always a negative sum game because the process of redistribution always results in the less efficient use of resources. And in conclusion, the world of economic policymaking tends to operate in the way that bad policies beget problems, which beget more bad policy responses, which beget even bigger problems, and so on. But you see, the trouble is that the powers that be, like Ben Bernanke, they don't understand this, and at least if they do, they're not prepared to pay lip service to it. I don't know why this is. I don't know whether they're just hoping that adding money and needless liquidity to the system will simply play for time while the economy gets ready to turn around and catch up with them. I don't know whether they do it on purpose in order to save their own skins because their giant experiment in money printing was a giant failure. I just don't know. I have no idea what goes on through their minds. But the incompetence is something to be seen, to behold. And it's not going to improve. These people have no better ideas. They have no idea what they're doing. And frankly, unfortunately, things are going to spiral out of control as they are doing as we speak. And the situation is going to become utterly and totally intolerable. Well, ladies and gentlemen, with that very bearish and despondent gloom to report, I must now sign off. It's the end of our hour. Have a wonderful weekend. I will be back with you next week, next Friday, same place, same time. Bye-bye till then.